Good morning, everyone. It's good to be able to share something with you all at forefront from God's Word again this morning. I'm sorry I can't be with you there in person, but I've moved my ECM office up to the Faroe Islands, where Dorrit and I are visiting supporters. This morning, we're continuing your series in Mark's Gospel, and we're in chapter 9. And as you've gone through the Gospel, you will have seen how the writer concentrates on a number of things. We see Jesus' power. His power over nature, his power over illness, and his power over evil. And the episode that we're going to be looking at this morning is an example of the last of these. How Jesus has power over evil. Now we're going to be in Mark's Gospel and chapter 9 and starting at verse 14. But I thought instead of reading this, I would do this slightly differently. And I'm using a clip from a video from the LUMO project, which I hope will perhaps bring this episode alive in a slightly different way from the way in which we are used to. So Mark chapter 9 and verse 14.
When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not."
"You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied. "How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me."
So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" He replied, "This kind can come out only by prayer."
A little bit of background will help us in understanding what's going on here. First, we need to remember the episode that's recorded in chapter 3 of Mark's Gospel, verses 20 to 24, where Jesus makes clear that victory over evil, over Satan, only happens when the strong man, that is Satan himself, has been tied up and is therefore unable to act. It is this victory that Jesus brings about which allows the release of the boy in our story. We also need to remember what has happened just before this episode in Mark's account. Jesus, with Peter, James, and John, have gone up a mountain where the disciples see Jesus revealed in his glory as he talks to Moses and Elijah. Now, the disciples do not fully understand what is going on, and that's nothing new. Of course, Mark's Gospel shows us that on a number of different occasions. So they come back down the mountain. And in a sense, they come down to earth with a very real bump. From the heavenly conversation between Jesus and Moses and Elijah, they come straight into an argument between the other disciples and the teachers of the law. Notice how Mark tells this. The disciples, Mark says, saw a large crowd having a row. The people saw Jesus. And the people were overwhelmed with wonder. Why? They'd probably, in all likelihood, seen Jesus at some time before. But I think here what we have is Mark doing something which he often does. He expects us to pick up on little clues from this story and to link it with other biblical accounts. On this occasion, he seems to be encouraging us to compare Jesus' descent from the high mountain with that of Moses, as recorded in Exodus 34 and verse 29, where we read this. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he'd spoken with the Lord. Instead, as in the story in Exodus of the people being afraid, here the people do, if you like, the exact opposite. Instead of wishing to stay away, they run towards Jesus to greet him. Now Peter, on the mountain, had seemed to put both Jesus and Moses on the same level. Unwittingly, no doubt, he wasn't really aware of what he was saying. But Mark is making the difference extremely plain here. Moses spoke with God, and the reflected glory of that encounter was too great for the people to bear. But here is Jesus, the one who is God, and the people instead come to greet him. The glory remains, but access to that glory, access to the presence of God and the reality of being with God is now open. And so the transfiguration of Jesus, where the three disciples see him in his heavenly glory, leads us to a clear demonstration in this episode of the fact that there is a transformation in access to that glory. Things have changed, and it is a glorious change. And so we come to the problem that's caused the argument between the teachers of the law and the disciples. Jesus asks, "What are you arguing about?" Now, when he poses that question, we don't know if he's addressing his disciples or the teachers or the crowd in general, but it probably doesn't really matter. And it doesn't matter because before either of these groups can answer, a man speaks up from the crowd. You can almost hear his frustration. You can almost hear the urgency of the situation in his voice. He briefly explains what the situation is, that situation concerning his son and the impure spirit. And then he says, "I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." So let's just imagine for a moment the man's excitement and anticipation as he was bringing his son to Jesus. Because that's what he says, "I brought you my son." He had no doubt heard or perhaps even seen Jesus perform miracles and wanted his son to be released in the same way as other people had been. He brings his son to Jesus. But the disciples were unable to bring about that release. That excitement must have changed to anguish. That anticipation changed to disappointment. And so I wonder what he actually expects Jesus to do now. Now, I'm going to make a wild guess. And I suggest that what he hopes Jesus will do is that he will immediately heal his son. That's what he'd brought his son to Jesus to do. That is, I think, what he had hoped that Jesus would immediately do. But that's not what Jesus does. What Jesus does first is to rebuke people and then ask a couple of questions, serious questions, before he turns finally to the man's son. Now, it's difficult to know exactly how Jesus said these words. The video interpreted them as coming from a frustration that Jesus might have had with his disciples especially. And that may well be what's going on. But the unbelieving generation that Jesus mentioned seems to be wider than the disciples. It seems to be directed at everyone, at disciples, teachers, people. The generation of God's people who had been waiting for the coming of their Messiah, and now that he had come, now that he stood right in front of them, they did not recognize him. And so perhaps this is a rebuke. Perhaps it's sadness. Sadness that despite what he had done, the people, even his disciples, still did not understand and believe. And so Jesus' question, how long shall I stay with you? This takes us straight back to the conversation Jesus had with the three disciples on the way down the mountain, talking about his death and his resurrection and how they didn't understand that. Another occasion when his disciples just do not get it. But before we are too hard on them, let's admit that we probably are no better, though we like to think we are. But the important aspect here as we go on in the story is that nothing else makes any sense until we recognize who Jesus is. The discussion of faith and about prayer that we'll come to has to be seen in this context. Who do we recognize Jesus as being? Mark is about to show us once again how Jesus displays who he truly is. And so they bring the man's son to Jesus. And immediately, that's one of Mark's favourite words, I think, the impure spirit throws the boy into a seizure. Now, at this juncture, it's probably worth saying a little bit about this. Much has been said and written about what disease or affliction this boy and others in the Gospels may or may not have had. Much has been made of trying to turn this into simply a medical issue. But in the terms of Mark's Gospel, the number of people who show themselves to be possessed by impure spirits is quite simply because Jesus is there, because the incarnation has happened, because God has come to earth in Jesus. The forces of evil are therefore ranged against him. The gates of hell are being shaken, and so they respond. And as I mentioned before, this is the strong man who has been tied up by the owner of the house and is able to bring about that strong man's demise. So it's clear that this attack on the man's son is, as a direct result of the demon recognizing who Jesus is. And it happens in other situations as well. How long has he been like this? Jesus asks. And I suggest he says that somewhat sorrowfully. Because this boy's predicament is a symptom, an awful symptom, of the issues that Jesus has come to destroy. He has come to bring an end to. And the answer is equally tragic, I think, since birth. This is a personal tragedy. It is a family tragedy, not just a cosmic one, not just a spiritual one. And so the man's helplessness comes out in his next statement. If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. There's a depth to the pain that is evident in that statement. And Jesus picks up on this. If you can. Jesus homes in on the central point. Is he able to bring victory over evil? Is he able to bring freedom to the captives? And then he goes on, everything is possible for one who believes. Wow. Now that's quite a statement. How are we going to unpack that? How are we going to understand that? How are we going to apply that? Notice what Jesus doesn't actually say. He doesn't say, if you believe, nothing is impossible for you to do. That is how some people have attempted to interpret what Jesus says here. That actually it's up to the individual's faith and how much faith that individual has, whether Jesus can perform miracles or not. And we will come back to this in just a moment. But no, Jesus' statement should more correctly be understood that belief leads to God performing miracles. But then we have to ask, well, what is the belief that does that? What is the fundamental belief? And I think Mark has shown us that and reminded us of that already. The fundamental belief, the thing that really matters, that really tells in this situation, is who people believe Jesus is. Mark shows that that belief has been growing and continues to grow through the gospel gradually as his disciples understand more and more. And so we come to the point, to the central verse of this little episode. And the man replies to Jesus, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And then as a further crowd seems to be rushing over and perhaps threatens to cause confusion and clamour and noise and distraction, Jesus heals the man's son. Does he do this because the man has a huge amount of faith? No. He does it despite the man's lack of faith. Or rather, because the man had a tiny amount of faith, but that tiny amount was put in the right place. That's the point. God performs miracles not because we have a huge amount of faith. God performs miracles because he is God. And when we recognize truly who he is, who Jesus is, then he will bring two things, at least according to this episode. First, he brings release from the power of evil. Victory over sin, as it is described elsewhere. Secondly, note how the boy was thought to be dead, but isn't. The second thing that Jesus brings is new life. Let us make no mistake. These are the two greatest miracles that God can perform for any of us. Release for the power of evil and new life in Jesus. Our minds are so often caught up by things of this world, whether it's health or it's money or it's jobs or whatever it may be. We can get so worked up about wanting God to do this, that, or the other for us, that actually we begin to forget, if we're not careful, that He has already done the most wonderful thing He can. He has brought us freedom and He has brought us life. And I think our desire for God sometimes to do all of these other things for us comes out of the fact that we forget just how wonderful those gifts of freedom and life that Jesus brings, how wonderful they really are. But it reminds us, as I mentioned a moment ago, that it's not the amount of faith we have that matters. It's where we place it. So think about that just for a moment. You may have heard, as I have, that if you have enough faith, God will do this. Or as someone once said to me, my spouse died because I did not have enough faith. That's a frightful and awful position to be in. And more, it is a totally unnecessary one. It can be helped, I think, when we remember a simple truth, but one that we could well do with repeating to ourselves. And that truth is this: God is God, and we are not. We cannot manipulate God, and we shouldn't even try to. God is not a great ATM in the sky who pours out just what we want, when we want, as long as we have the right pin. God is God, and we are not. And I think if you consider it for a while, you'll come to the same conclusion as I have. I do not want a God who can be manipulated into doing what I want, because that God is not God. This story reminds us that God brings freedom and God brings life through Jesus. And He does so even though our faith is weak. Why? Because He is a great God. The disciples hadn't fully got this yet. And so later on, away from the crowds, they ask why they couldn't bring freedom and life, why they couldn't drive out the impure spirit. And Jesus gives what is, on one hand, a very simple, straightforward answer, and on another, a very complex answer. And He says this: this kind can only come out by prayer. We think, if we're not careful. So while I may not be able to get God to do my bidding by having an enormous amount of faith, He will do it if I pray enough. Now, I'm pretty certain that's not what Jesus is saying here. God can no more be manipulated by prayer than He can by faith, because God is God. Now, we could here go into a long discussion on prayer, but that perhaps needs to await a different time. But what is prayer about? I suggest what is important about it here from this episode is that fundamentally prayer reminds us who God is and who we are in relationship to God. And so it is a wonderful thing. as we pray, we understand more of who God is. We understand more of his wonder, more of his glory. Prayer does for us what the mountain experience did for the three disciples. It brings us into the presence of the glorified King Jesus. And having seen what Peter's response was, we know that our response has to be different. Not to bring Jesus down to the same level as mere mortals, Moses and Elijah, however great they may have been. It has to be the response of Ezekiel to the vision he receives at the beginning of his prophecy. It is to fall face down before the glory of God. It is to recognize that God is God and we are not. That is what prayer does. So these things, Jesus says, only come about through prayer. The recognition of who we are before God. So, unlike Peter on the mountain, let's not try to share Jesus' glory with anyone else, especially not with ourselves. Rather like this man with the possessed son, let us approach Jesus with the small amount of faith that we might have and expect him to do miracles. Because God is God. And we are not.